From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! In the wake of the Heaven's Gate mass suicide, we look at apocalyptic movements on the eve of the new millennium. Then a midnight deadline tonight for the Navajo Indians who want to remain on their ancestral land.
Well, this is our sacred land where we offer, pray, do the offering to the Mother Earth and to the trees and to the mountains, to the spring, to the rocks, to the prairies.
We all make our living off of our livestock. Our livestock is a security to us. Like, you have your money in your bank, you know, that's your something to fall back on. And to us, our livestock is like that, you know. And even if we don't have jobs or anything like that, that is our way of making a living. That's our survival.
And on this last day of Women's History Month, good wives, nasty wenches, and anxious patriarchs, gender, race, and power in colonial Virginia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's been nearly 2 years since the Oklahoma City bombing, and now the task is to find jurors who'll decide the innocence or guilt of suspect Timothy McVeigh, and perhaps whether he will die. Lawyers were to begin choosing 12 jurors and 6 alternates today from the same jury pool the defense team labeled as poisoned by media reports of McVeigh's purported confessions. This news from Fayetteville, North Carolina, now that an ex-paratrooper has been sentenced to life in prison for the hate killings of 2 African Americans, attention turns to the trial of the man prosecutors claim was his accomplice. Former Fort Bragg soldier Malcolm Wright will be tried on charges that he killed a black couple in Fayetteville, with jury selection scheduled to begin today. This news from the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, high-ranking Army officials have made it impossible for a former drill sergeant to get a fair trial on 25 counts of rape, a defense lawyer says. Attorneys for Staff Sergeant Delmar Simpson were expected to seek the dismissal of the case before the trial begins April 7th. They claim the case has been tainted by, quote, unlawful command influence, in particular public statements by top Army officials emphasizing the seriousness of the offenses. This news from Hanoi, a Taiwanese supervisor at a factory in Vietnam, which makes Nike shoes, will stand trial for allegedly abusing her employees. This, according to a Labor Department official in the southern province of Dong Nai today. The official, who declined to be named, said police had started prosecution procedures against the woman for allegedly forcing 56 workers to jog twice around the 1.2-mile factory perimeter for failing to wear regulation work shoes. This news from California: despite decades of efforts to improve the lot of American farm workers, wages for the nation's more than 2 million farm laborers have trailed stubbornly behind inflation for the past 20 years, making it hard for many of them to afford adequate housing and other necessities. And this last international news: having won an agreement from Arab League officials to pressure Israel, Yasser Arafat has turned his attention to the United States. The Palestinian leader wants Washington to stand up for the peace accords the U.S. helped negotiate. Arafat says the accord included a pledge not to pump new settlers into Palestinian areas of Jerusalem. In Cairo, Arab League foreign ministers yesterday recommended a freeze in relations with Israel because of its settlement policies. They're weighing further measures today. And you're listening to Democracy Now! 2 former followers of the Heaven's Gate group insisted the deaths of 39 members were not a mass suicide, and one regretted that he didn't die with the rest of the Rancho Santa Fe mansion. He said, "I wish I had the strength to have remained, to have stuck it out and gotten stronger and continued to be a part of that group." This was former member Nick Cook, who told CBS's 60 Minutes his wife Suzanne Sylvia Cook was among the dead. Cook said his wife had, quote, shed her container and is now aboard a spaceship with 38 colleagues, including the group's leader, Marshall Applewhite. Joining us right now to talk about this issue is Juan Gonzalez, who's just returned from San Diego, where, Juan, you've been writing pieces for the New York Daily News on what's happened to the cult and the aftermath.
Yes. Good morning, Amy. And it's good to be back in the relative sanity of New York City after a few days in San Diego.
Our apologies to San Diego listeners.
But I would say that that the one of the most amazing things to me about the news that's come out on Heaven's Gate, on the Heaven's Gate group, is one, the relative maturity of most of the people there. Originally, the original reports obviously were that they were in their 20s, when in fact only five of them were either in their 20s or their 30s. Most were in their mid to late 40s, and many were in their 50s and 60s, and one even in the 70s. So this was clearly a group of people that had been long involved in the Heaven's Gate group, had firm convictions. And according to the people that I spoke to who worked with them, for instance, there was a group of three of them who worked at a company called the Arrowhead General Insurance Agency as computer workers there, were amazingly brilliant and well-liked. This was a group of people that, to all intents and purposes, seemed a monastic group, as they called themselves, brothers and sisters, and they called their house their mansion, which, by the way, most people in Rancho Santa Fe insist is not really a mansion. It's just an ordinary house, because that's the Beverly Hills of San Diego. But they called their place a monastery. One of their supervisors at work actually said, I guess their beliefs were as deep as the religion that most of us have in us. And there was tremendous admiration for them. Even following their death, their supervisor said, I guess they did what they wanted to do. At least they didn't involve any children. They didn't hurt anyone else or damage property. I don't agree with them, but I don't think any less of them for what happened. So I think that on the one hand, you've got this very sensational sort of look at an extremist cult on the part of the media, and yet on part of people who have dealt with them on a regular basis and come to know them is much more respect for this group.
Now, you spent a little time at the workplace of some of those who were part of this group. And you were talking to a number of the people there, and they had a party for them before they left. And they said that, it's according to you at least, that they talked about their group. It wasn't a total secret. They had some idea of who they were.
Oh, yes. No, they clearly were not secretive. They did talk about belonging to being a part of the group, and that they had been, in fact, when they all announced that they were quitting at one time, they said that their group had another project, that they were going on a trip. And the police have indicated that in the house, in the Rancho Santa Fe mansion, there were maps on the walls indicating that the group was preparing to go overseas, that there were several countries that they were conceivably going to from California, and one of them actually talked about the triple witching hour to their fellow employees, which they considered the coincidence of the Hale-Bopp comet, the lunar eclipse, and the bright appearance of Mars in the skies, which all happened the previous weekend, the Palm Sunday weekend, which is. Seems to be around the time when the mass suicide started.
There's also been some discussion that's come out in the news in the last day that the head of the group, Applewhite, had said that he was going to die, perhaps of liver cancer. And so they did, in their autopsy of him, they said that, in fact, he didn't look like what he was going to die. But people said he would discuss that. And some of the members had said they didn't want to be around if he were no longer around. I guess he was called Doe by his followers.
Right.
Well, the mass suicide of the Heaven's Gate group has again highlighted the importance of apocalyptic visions in the social and political landscape of America. From the Christian Identity Movement to the Freemen of Montana, the idea that the end of the world is near, or that a much better world is at hand, whether at some vague higher level or through the return of Jesus Christ, appears to be growing as we get closer to the year 2000. And we're joined now by Chip Burleigh, who is with Political Research Associates, which is a group based in Somerville, Massachusetts, that monitors the political right in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chip.
Good morning.
Morning. Well, can you tell us about your thoughts of the Heaven's Gate view of the world that we've gotten from their website and also from former group members who are talking, and how you see this fitting in to the landscape of politics today in America?
Well, when you look at Heaven's Gate, you have to see three prophetic themes merged with the dynamic of manipulative demagoguery on the part of the group leader. I think it would be real useful to throw away the terms between now and the end of the millennium, extremist and cult. I think Juan Gonzalez is right in his sense that these were otherwise pretty average people, in fact, probably above average. People who get drawn into these kinds of sects or movements tend to be of above-average intelligence. They tend to be seekers for some higher truth or seeking to have some commitment to the greater social good, and they often have the best of intentions. They get drawn into groups led by a strong, charismatic leader who then manipulates their longings towards some power relationship where he's in control. Usually it's a he. It's very rarely a woman, but occasionally. So the three prophetic themes are the Book of Revelations, the prophecies of Nostradamus, which I dare say you probably aren't up on. I spent yesterday at a bookstore picking up books on Nostradamus, which talks about a comet. And the prophetic ideas in science fiction, the specific genre of higher consciousness and higher beings or dualism, the idea that humans or some group of humans are seated on this planet, but their future lies in some ascension and transformation into a higher state or to join a higher race of space aliens. Now, take a deep breath. For many people, the ideas of Nostradamus, the Book of Revelations, and sci-fi are not how they generally run their lives. But as we approach the year 2000, more and more otherwise sensible people are going to be caught up in what's called millennial fervor. And if you look across a number of recent movements that have seemed very exotic, you see aspects of holy war, Armageddon in the Book of Revelation, the idea that Christians need to reign and rule before Christ returns, the idea of transcendent ascension and the rapture, in which in the Book of Revelations, Christians are raptured up into the heavens before there are great tribulations. And then this doomsday apocalyptic cataclysmic idea that the survivalists and the militia movement is into. So there's all sorts of kind of popular culture that is playing with these ideas and coming up with their own derivations.
Chip, do you think that there are things within the American society itself that make it fertile ground for the rise of these types of organizations or movements? I mean, I'm thinking specifically, for instance, about the actual Protestant origins of the country itself through the proliferation of religious sects from the very beginning of the country, and then also the question of whether the social contradictions in American society, because when you hear the tapes of a lot of the Heaven's Gate people, they were profoundly upset about the nature of American society and that they somehow seem to have become disconnected from what they saw as the problems or the that a country as great as America or as rich as America should supposedly not have.
Well, I think you put your finger on the two central themes here. One is that things aren't right in the country, that the economy is designed to make the wealthy wealthier. Look at the Federal Reserve monkeying with interest rates to keep, you know, poor and working people poor and working harder rather than trying to allow the economy to grow so that more people can find jobs. Look at the social contradictions in the country around race and gender and sexual orientation and all of these issues, which we as a society are trying to pretend aren't really problems, and yet you have this racist attack against the young African-American man in Chicago. You have incredible unresolved issues. Ooh, coming to the end of Women's Month, you know, patriarchy still rules in this country. It's been eroded slightly, but it's not gone away. So between these social issues and the economic issues, which are very real, then people then look for answers. And sometimes they look for answers in forms that are either scapegoating or transcendent. And that's what you see around the world in other countries that are affected by these situations. You either have racial nationalism, which is a kind of circle the wagons approach. You have a religious fundamentalism or religious transcendent, you know, separate yourself movements. And you have this kind of right-wing populism, which is just throw the bums out. You know, things stink, and we don't care what the change is as long as there's change. In this country, Protestantism brought us this idea of Satan, of the demon, and the idea of demonization, which led to the witch hunts in Salem and has led to witch hunts throughout our society and ends up very often in these scapegoating kinds of allegations of tremendous conspiracies behind everything.
Chip Berlay, even the idea of the spaceship, as a friend was pointing out earlier, is not, you know, singular to this group, unique to this group. I mean, you have the Nation of Islam that talks about the mothership.
That's correct. And you have Nostradamus talking about the comet coming, and maybe that means that there's something you can catch ahead of time. You have the science fiction genre like Arthur C. Clarke's novel Childhood's End that talks about people being caught up into a higher transcendent status of being with space aliens as the guide. So, and there's actually many, many books with that genre. So what you have here is someone who cobbled together themes that are quite common in American culture, rooted in this apocalyptic demonization that the Protestants, myself included, brought to this country. I apologize. Many of us don't think like this. And then we come to this issue of, as we approach the millennium, how does a society deal with devout Christians that take the Bible literally? And more of them are expecting the end times and some cataclysm, and how we deal with that that respects the First Amendment but protects people from the more bigoted and scapegoating aspects that in the past Christianity has applied toward its vision of the apocalypse.
What do you make of the technological bent, the emphasis on computers and their website? And is that increasingly something that millennial groups are gravitating towards as a means of expressing themselves in this our changing times?
Well, sure. And you have to look back at the history, for instance, of Christian evangelicalism, which embraced the printing press and radio and TV very quickly, ahead of most other social movements in the world, so that you have that idea of proselytizing and reaching out and recruiting using high tech. Nothing new in terms of proselytizing in terms of spiritual movements. But also, hey, you know, I'm a sci-fi freak. If you're going to be up on the mothership, you're going to have to know how to use the equipment. So at least, you know, before you go off and drive a car, you got to learn, you know, how it works. So I think the emphasis there was just very compatible with their idea that they were going to be going to a kind of technology where, you know, they would probably be considered cretins, but at least they'd know how to program in HTML.
Well, you know, I wanted to get to the biggest question of all, and of course we have the least amount of time to do it, but like on the front page of the Christian Science Monitor today, its piece on the whole issue says, underneath the biggest cult story in the U.S. in 20 years lies an enduring question, what is spirituality? And it really does sort of make us look at what is religion, what is a cult?
Oh, that's the question, huh? Wow. Well, it's a tough question, and it really has to do with two issues in my mind. Is the knowledge that's being offered being readily shared and people encouraged to study it openly, or is it some kind of variation on Gnostic skullduggery and scam in which you have to pay an admission fee that is increasingly high, either monetarily or in terms of your own identity, to get this revealed knowledge? So is the knowledge being offered up front openly, and you can decide to opt in? I mean, nobody calls somebody who's in a nunnery or a monastery as part of a cult, or at least they shouldn't. You know what you're getting into. But if you don't know what you're getting into, then there's a deception. And so it's this idea of is the knowledge revealed only to the elect, or is it available to anyone to pick and choose from? And then the other one is the deception. Are you told up front what the outcome is going to be, what's going to be expected of you? And to me, the difference between a spiritual orthodox group that has very high standards and a group that I would call totalitarian is its openness and its honesty. And if it's deceptive and if it's trying to claim that only the leader has this revealed knowledge and you gain entry only through him, then I think it's a totalitarian group, which is the term I prefer to cult. But to just say cults are bad and don't think about what it means and extremists are bad, so, you know, Martin Luther King was an extremist by that definition. A cult is any religious group that challenges the status quo. There are a lot of people who believe in New Age spirituality that aren't in cults. So we have to be careful and rethink some of this.
Chipperle, can you tell us how people can find your writings on the right-wing militias in this country and various cult groups on the web?
Cult
if people
groups,
aren't
huh,
too...
Amy?
If people aren't afraid to go to the web anymore.
Of course, we have a webpage, publiceye.org. We have a special section on
PublicEye, PublicEye
.org. Mm-hmm. And we have something there on the Oklahoma City bombing and on the Heaven's Gate group.
Well, thank you very much, Chipperle, for joining us this morning.
And remember, it's only going to get worse.
Chipperle of Political Research Associates, which is based in Massachusetts. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tonight is a major deadline for the Navajo and Hopi of northeastern Arizona. In northeastern Arizona, in a region known as Big Mountain, hundreds of Navajo Diné families are facing imminent eviction from their land and livelihoods. For nearly 25 years, the Diné have fought an alliance of energy companies, the U.S. government, and sectors of the Hopi, a tribe that also lives there, for control over the coal-rich land that they've lived on since before the arrival of Columbus. Already 12,000 Navajo have been uprooted since the early 1970s, and now the remaining 2,000 Diné residents face a deadline of today to sign a draconian lease or face eviction. Before we turn to our guests in the studio, I wanted to go back 10 years, 1987, when I went out to the Big Mountain area and spoke with some of the Navajo elders there about their plight.
Well, this is our sacred land where we offer, pray, do the offering to the Mother Earth and to the trees and to the mountains, to the spring, to the rocks, to the prairies.
We all make our living off of our livestock. You know, our livestock is a security to us. Like, you have your money in your bank, you know, that's your something to fall back on. And to us, our livestock is like that, you know. And even if we don't have jobs or anything like that, that is our way of making a living. And that's our survival.
Then, in Arizona, two Navajo women whose lives revolve around the Indian reservation. They fear the loss of that which is most sacred to them, the land, the sheep, and passing these on to the next generation.
The land is my home. It's where I grew up. It's where I live all my life. I have a place to go when I'm sad. I have a place to be when I'm happy. I have, you know, I just know which way to go. I know the land like the back end of my hand.
In 1974, Congress passed Public Law 93531, calling for the partitioning of 2 million acres of reservation land to resolve a so-called Navajo-Hopi land dispute. This land had previously been known as the joint use area, shared by both the Navajo and Hopi. The partitioning meant the relocation of 100 Hopi and 10,000 Navajo. I went out to Arizona to talk to the Indians about their fight to remain on their land. The traditional Hopi and Navajo don't see the problem as a land dispute between their two tribes. They say they stand united against the U.S. government and energy companies who are using the unrepresentative Hopi Tribal Council to clear the Navajo off the land for future energy development. In fact, one of the men who pushed through the congressional relocation bill became vice president of Peabody Coal a year later. The company has a lease to develop the land, which can only happen if there are no people on it. The Hopi have already moved, but less than half of the Navajo have signed away their rights to the area some families have occupied for centuries. Many refuse to leave, the most vocal, the female Navajo elders, like Roberta Blackoat.
The woman has more power than the man, I would say. When the woman gets pregnant and carries a little infant in the air for 9 months, and then when she gets real heavy, how terrible movement that she has to have in order to get up. And then when the child is born, of course, it gives a thumbprint on the Mother Earth. And so the ladies always have to be strong. And that's just the way it is.
I was just taught never to, if I hear you speaking in Navajo, I will wash your mouth out with soap, you know, that's what we were told. And so we try to speak English, but, you know, but I don't think it really worked, because we always whisper to each other.
Betty Tso is a 21-year-old Navajo. She lives on her family's land on the Hopi side of the congressional partition line. She calls herself a resistor, saying she will not leave her home. The congressional law that relocates all Navajo from Hopi land constitutes the largest physical relocation of Native Americans in United States history.
Lou Gerwitz is the founder of the Big Mountain Legal Defense Offense Committee. He was also a wounded knee defense lawyer.
What we hope the repeal bill will do, it's not just to throw away the law, because there's too many entanglements at this point. So what we say we want in the repeal bill is nobody is forced to move, neither Hopi nor Navajo, nobody. Anybody who has moved has the right to move back, because it's clear to all of us who've been involved and to many others that the relocation program is a complete failure, and it's just bringing misery and devastation into the lives of the people who are subjected to it. And that our third point is that anyone who wants to move, any of the Navajo people or Hopis who have signed a contract with the government to be relocated, to get the benefits, and still feel that they want to go through that, that they be allowed, that the government is forced to honor its contract and allow those people to move. And our fourth point is that whatever is owed to the Hopis be paid to the Hopis, but not by the Navajos. It's not the Navajos who forced anything upon the Hopis. It's not the Navajos who took anything from the Hopis. It's the same United States government that affected the Navajos, the Hopi, the Cheyenne, the Pueblos, the Zunis, all of the nations. The only way this petition makes any sense is if you know that this is the Peabody lease area here, see? And if you follow the veins of this mine, you'll see that the veins run right down this way, right through the Hopi petition land, right through where Big Mountain is.
Much research has been done on the extent of energy interests in fueling the so-called land dispute. If the Navajo are moved off their land, it can be more easily developed. It is estimated that 21 billion tons of coal, uranium, oil, and natural gas exist under the disputed area. During the early 70s, a public interest firm from Salt Lake City, known as Evans & Associates, was hired by the Hopi tribe. It staged disputes between Hopi and Navajo to create the impression that the tribes were engaging in range wars. It was the height of the American Indian Movement, and Congress was scared of more Indian violence. A consortium of energy companies was also a client of Evans & Associates. The lawyer for the Hopi tribe was also the lawyer for the Peabody Coal Company, which was signing leases for reservation land with both tribes. With three bills currently introduced to Congress that would modify or repeal the 1974 relocation bill, it is unclear what the fate of the Navajo will be. But the traditional Navajo and Hopi are standing united. They see themselves as protectors of the earth. They don't want their land developed. They don't want their friends and family moved. The Navajo are a matrilineal society. Charlotte Bayon.
The land where my mother is, it belongs, it, you know, the women take care of it. The men, her brothers, you know, they can, they get married. They go to where their wife's place are, and they help out over there, their helper. And they help their children in those areas, and wherever they move to, wherever they choose to marry. My father's like that. My father moved down to Greasewood, where my mother's from. Okay. And for me, I'm the female too in my family. So it's kind of I guess like a fish would have a spawning ground. That's where our home is. That's where our roots are. That's our foundation. And we go back. We take care of the land. We perform the ceremonies for the land. And for the people who are on it, the animals that are on it, the plants that are on it, that it will continue and that it would thrive.
It is the elder Navajo women who are standing up to the fencers and getting arrested. Roberta Blackoat.
We've been done a lot of pulling out a fencing, cutting the barbed wires and all these things that we let them to do that. Just gather them in and of course some strong ladies. And we did pull out this fencing because we're not allowed to have all these pins set in line on our Mother Earth. You know how it is when you had a little splinter in your finger or on your feet, it hurts. Then all you've got to do is prick it out and then you'll have no pain. And this is how she is. She's in pain with all this fencing covered all over on her body. So this is what we're having standing for, to protection. Or Mother Earth.
If the law isn't repealed and they try to relocate you, what will you do?
Well, I've been standing for repealing this public law, the most monster law that we've ever had on this reservation. And so, I'm not standing for failing. I'm standing for, with my strong feeling, to win this public law. For me, I wouldn't be able to be relocated. I don't care whether if a tractor come and try to dig me out and pour me out somewhere. I still return and sit there again, like a stink bug. You throw it away and then you return next day, will be right there again.
Many of the resistors live around the Big Mountain area, the land of the female mountain. The Navajo female elders have captured the hearts and imaginations of people around the world. American singer Laura Nero recently wrote a song for a film on the Navajo Hopi ordeal called Broken Rainbow.
An old woman of the old ways, she said, I recall my joy in better days. Young warriors of the open rainbow said, tell me, is it true?
And so the Native Americans continue the struggle for their birthright, a thumbprint on Mother Earth.
Well, I'll just load up my gun and then start walk out towards them if they start coming to me. I had my heart beating kind of strong all the time, so I don't have any fear. So really, I think that we're going to win to have our land back.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! That was 10 years ago, Roberta Black Oath, the last person to speak, when I went out to the Navajo and Hopi land of Big Mountain. Right now, we're joined in the studio by Bonnie Weitzinger, a traditional Navajo Diné who is facing eviction. Also, Marcia Monasterski is with us, who's been organizing at the United Nations and elsewhere in support of the sovereign Diné Nation's fight against relocation. And tonight at midnight is the deadline. Bonnie, can you tell us what this deadline is and what you're doing about it?
Well, this March 31st deadline is to sign on to the accommodation agreement, which originated from Public Law 401-301, which the land is awarded by Congress to Hopi and for their exclusive use, and that we're threatened with the February 2000 Quiet Title, and that it could go in effect any time because there's a lack of good faith on behalf of the Hopi Tribal Council.
What happens if you don't sign over your land by midnight tonight?
There's a threat of a quiet title, which is being imposed in by the U.S. government, and that they're using the Hopi tribe to channel their activities, and that we are being subjected to Hopi jurisdiction.
So, in essence, then the federal government would take title to the land and turn it over to the Hopis?
Well, the Hopis are going to get paid the rest of the $50.2 million for the percentage the Hopi tribe gets out of signatures and from the HPL community, which is Hopi partitioned land in the Big Mountain area and in the vicinities where the communities are affected.
Well, Marcia, you've been doing work at the United Nations to raise this issue. Has there been any results, or is the United States just refusing to recognize even UN involvement in any way?
Well, because we've exhausted all the remedies in the United States court system, what we've done is we've made this an international issue. And we have the support of the chairperson on the Subcommittee for Human Rights in the European Parliament. We have the support of the full European Parliament, the Flemish Parliament, member nations of the European Parliament from throughout Europe. We also have the support of numerous NGOs within the United Nations. And just last Friday on the 28th, an article appeared in a Belgium newspaper, which is equivalent to the New York Times. And it's called Nespa Batsat. And there was a lengthy article, and a woman had attended last week the Committee on the Status of Women NGO and governmental meeting that went on for 2 weeks at the United Nations. So we have a lot of support in the United Nations and a press conference coming up today there.
I have to say it's quite unbelievable that this deadline is midnight at the end of Women's History Month. What could be more historic when you're talking about Navajo, particularly female elders, fighting for their ancestral lands? What about the U.S. Congress?
The U.S. Congress needs to be pushed by the United States public. And everyone out there, the United States public, needs to call your senators and representatives wherever you live. Call them, visit them, occupy their offices as long as it takes to get a dialogue with them, because we need to push the Human Rights Caucus within Congress, and we need to make this an issue within Congress, because this is where the mistake was made, and this is where the mistake needs to be fixed. And we need a congressional oversight investigation, a GAO investigation by Congress of everything that's been going on, and a United Nations investigation of the human rights abuses.
Are there any in Congress that have stood firm in opposition to this kind of injustice?
What I'd highly recommend is that we put pressure on Joe Trujillo, who is the legislative aide for Senator Domenici. He sits on the Senate Committee for Indian Affairs. He's in New Mexico in Albuquerque this week. His phone number is 505-766-3481.
One more time.
505-766-3481. Next week he'll be back in Washington. The phone number there is 202-224-6621. Senator Domenici stopped the bill one time. He can do it again. We need intervention, especially by the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs.
Bonnie, as we wrap up, can you describe what is happening right now? You've just come out to speak around the country about what's happening in Big Mountain area. What is happening there now with livestock and with land?
there are results of human rights abuse, and in general, there's livestock confiscation where they impound the animals, and wood confiscation, denial to water, and decent homes, and there's a religious practices are being tormented by permit systems and policies, and there's a lot of harassment by the Hopi agency, and that there's elders and child abuse going on at this moment, and that so we are faced with a lot of pressure from the Hopi Indian Agency.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Marcia, one last comment?
One last comment is we need the United States public to know that it's $350 million of your taxpayer dollars that has been used to fund relocation of traditional indigenous people from their homeland. So we need you to call your congressmen and senators and Joe Trujillo for Senator Domenici and tell them that you do not want your tax dollars funding relocation.
Well, I want to thank you for being here. Marcia Monasterski, who's been organizing at the United Nations in support of the sovereign Diné Nation. Diné is the traditional name for the Navajo. And also Bonnie Whitesinger, traditional Navajo Diné, who is facing eviction and has refused to sign away her land. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Juan had to leave, Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News. But right now we're joined by a very interesting historian. Kathleen Brown is with us. Today marks the last day of Women's History Month. And to commemorate the day, we're going to take a special look back at one of the defining eras for women in America, the colonial period. Thought this was an interesting contrast to our previous guest, a Navajo woman who was here long before the colonists came in. But this was a period where the creation of gender roles was crucial, both in the establishment of racial slavery in this country and of a patriarchal social and political system. Kathleen Brown is professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and author of a new book called Good Wives, Nasty Wenches, and Anxious Patriarchs, Gender, Race, and Power in Colonial Virginia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me on the program, Amy.
Good Wives, Nasty Wenches, and Anxious Patriarchs. How did you come up with that title?
Well, each part of the title actually represents a group of people and also a changing set of attitudes toward that group of people. Good Wives really refers to English ideals for the wife of a prosperous yeoman farmer. It was a term that was used in England and also used in colonial America to describe the wife of this farmer. In Virginia, of course, there were tobacco farms as opposed to subsistence farms that there were in England. And this term was also used as an ideal for the kind of women who should come to help settle Virginia. Nasty Wenches was a term that came from a pamphlet put out by a promoter of the colony of Virginia who was trying to convince English women that if they came to Virginia, they wouldn't have to work in tobacco fields, that only nasty wenches would work in tobacco fields, and that really respectable English women would be doing domestic work as they might have done in England. And the term nasty wenches changes over the course of the 17th century and comes to refer more and more to women of African descent who largely replaced English women doing field work in the tobacco fields. And the term anxious patriarchs refers to a sort of precariously situated group of elite white planters who, although they clearly had the most power and the most property and the most political clout in the colony, were never quite sure enough of their authority. They were constantly being challenged by disobedient wives and disobedient children and unruly, they believed, unruly laborers in their households.
Now, how does this all fit in with the definition of slavery?
Well, one of the things that I was interested in is how a society like that of early modern England, where gender and class were so important to how people understood the social order, how that society became transformed through migration and settlement and a change in the economy to one where racial slavery was the main foundation of social order. So part of what I was interested in is how English settlers went from a people who understood social order in terms of class and gender to one in which race was at least as important to them as gender. And some people would argue even trumped class as the main way that society was organized.
So how did it go from one to the other?
Well, what I found was that, first of all, there were big shifts in the supply of English servants during the course of the century. And as the supply of English servants dried up, so to speak, in the last part of the century, English planters became much more interested in using African labor. And so that's certainly one of the ways that this transition happened. But the other way it happened is that English lawmakers in the colony defined African people out of the roles that they deemed appropriate for civilized people. And those roles were very gendered roles. They were roles that had to do with what women, respectable women, were supposed to do in the household to contribute to the household economy, and what respectable, honorable men did that gave them political recognition and political input into the society.
And where did Native American women fit in here? I'm looking in your book at a print of Pocahontas at the age of 20.
Well, in some ways, Native American women were the second, perhaps the third encounter that English people had with a group of non-English people who organized their economy in very different ways than the English had. And among Native Americans, women had a very active role growing crops, for example. They did a lot of field work. They did a lot of agricultural work with hoes. And this presented a stark contrast to English ideals for what civilized women should be doing. English commentators on Native Americans often said that Native American women worked like drudges while their men were goofing off fishing and hunting, which the English viewed as leisure activities.
We're talking to Kathleen Brown, who's author of the book Good Wives, Nasty Wenches, and Ancient and Anxious Patriarchs, Gender, Race, and Power in Colonial Virginia. Can you explain what the Bacon's Rebellion of 1676 was and how it fits into your picture of how racial slavery came about and was enforced?
Bacon's Rebellion was, in essence, a sort of a civil war between two groups of elite English settlers, one a more well-established group that had a longer history in the colony and was more entrenched in the positions of power in the colonial government, and the other a group of relative newcomers who had managed to recruit smaller white landowners and in some cases newly freed white male servants to their cause. It's a turning point in the history of the colony in that after this rebellion, the lines along which white men, white and black, were distinguished became much sharper. And so it is the moment that many historians believe, at least in the realm of formal politics and the law, that men began to have stronger solidarity along racial lines, and in particular, smaller white planters and property owners began to ally themselves more directly with elite white men.
Who was Lucy Park Bird?
Lucy Park Bird was the wife of a very prominent Virginia planter who has left one of the strangest and one of the most widely used diaries of the period. He kept a diary of what he ate every day, what he read every day, every time he went to the bathroom and every time he had sex. And as a result, we know quite a bit about Lucy Park Bird, although we know about it only through the eyes of her somewhat odd husband.
So what do you know about her?
Well, she comes down to us through historical interpretation as a very tempestuous, temperamental woman. And indeed, in the way she treated her enslaved laborers, she seems to have been quite brutal. She could be capable of meting out very brutal punishments. But on the other hand, we also have this image of her through her husband's diary, and he was clearly kind of a control freak. And so on the one hand, one sees evidence of really harsh treatment of people of African descent in her household at her hands. And on the other hand, we see the way her husband treated her, which was to try and control her diet, to try and control her exercise, and in a very self-centered way to record in his diary every time they had sexual intercourse, which he thought of very much in terms of an exhibition of his own power.
Talking about sex, it brings to mind the idea, the notion, the bigoted stereotype that white males used to control black men because they were afraid that their own women would be defiled by them. How does that play into your picture?
Well, towards the end of the 17th century, what we find happening in Virginia courts, and it is indicative of, I think, racial stereotypes that develop much later on. We think of them as developing much later on. I'm arguing, actually, that they have their beginnings in the 17th century. Increasingly, courts who had that had previously been concerned with illegitimate children, because it cost communities money when children were born out of wedlock, became much less concerned with illegitimate children unless they were the children of white servant women. In other words, they didn't really care to find out the paternity of those children. And they became particularly concerned if white servant women were having children of mixed race. And so a kind of a fear based in part, I think, on of efforts to keep men of African descent in a servile positions within colonial society, a fear of African men as incredibly virile, as oversexed, as capable of rebellion, and as lusting after white women arose in part out of the concern to regulate the sexuality of white women.
How did free people of color fit in here?
Well, in some ways, I feel like I had more to say about free people of color because they tended to appear in the court records more often. There was a very small community of free people of color. And first of all, one of the ways it fits into this whole discussion of gender is that the sort of gender loophole to freedom for people of color was through a free mother. And so many of these free people of color trace their freedom to a free woman who had somehow managed to get herself free and then ended up in the courts to try and keep her children from being mistaken or deliberately taken for slaves. So I found lots of evidence of very tiny networks of free people of color, sometimes spanning several generations, where I actually could trace a white woman's involvement with a black man to produce a child who was technically free, and then over the generations, that child's continued connection to both white people and people of African descent. So free people of color sort of bordered both white and black communities.
You mentioned Lucy Park Bird being brutal when it came to, when it came to slavery and what she did. I mean, people would argue that anyone who had slaves were brutal, whatever you did to the slaves. But what about women? Was there a distinction in the way women viewed slavery and men viewed slavery in colonial Virginia?
Well, I mean, part of what I've tried to argue...
I mean, white women.
Yes. Yeah. Part of what I've tried to argue is... we know from other historians that in formal political and legal realms, white men began to see themselves in very racial terms as sharing something, even if in class terms they seem to share nothing in terms of the amount of property they own. For white women, I think there's a really quite different situation. Their concerns were less with things like political rebellion and the rebellion of the lower orders, and more about respectability derived from household work. They were more concerned, I think, in many ways, to cast off the stigma of the colony's early history, that early history of English nasty wenches, onto black women. And they did this through the way they assigned labor in their households and in the way they treated the black women in their household. So in the small politics of the household, I think we can see white women as being complicit in the creation of racial slavery.
Did you follow any particular black women in colonial Virginia?
I did. They're harder to follow because they're often, they appear in the court records only identified by a first name, and they might appear once in a lifetime. And so it's awfully hard to build a kind of biographical profile around one tiny mention in the court records. The women I had the most success in writing about, women of color I had the most success in writing about, tended to be the free women of color, who in fact appeared much more regularly in the courts. They seemed more involved in the activities of the court, in part because they were free and in part because lacking other alternatives, using the law was the best way they had to protect their own freedom and the freedom of their children. So those are the women women of color I tended to write about the most.
Well, on this last day of Women's History Month, Kathleen Brown, what is your research and your years of investigation into gender, race, and power in colonial Virginia tell us about today?
Well, I think one thing it tells us is that when we talk about gender and race and class as if they're separate categories that are somehow connected, and we often really don't know what we mean when we say they're connected, one of the things I actually tried to show is that in their very history, they're absolutely codependent on each other, that there really is no such thing as having a gender in this country without having a racial identity and a class position, whether one is white or whether one is black. And so that's part of what I tried to show in this study.
You started this many years ago as a graduate student. It was your dissertation, is that right?
That's correct.
And you expanded it into a book. Are you surprised as you went along your way by anything that you learned?
Actually, I was surprised to find as many free people of color as I did find in the court records. I was surprised at the degree to which English women seem to have a very clear notion of respectability that seemed to parallel that that appeared in the pamphlets written by men. In fact, they seemed to share that, and I was surprised by that. I think I originally was a bit naive, thinking that I would find a somewhat more separate women's culture, perhaps a more separate set of values that women might have shared, and in fact, I didn't find that. At least not in a way that transcended race and class.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Kathleen Brown. Your book, Good Wives, Nasty Wenches, and Anxious Patriarchs, Gender, Race, and Power in Colonial Virginia, is published by the Institute of Early American History and Culture, as I read around that circle. If people want to get a hold of this book and they don't see it in their bookstore, do you have a number they can call?
Yes, there's a 1-800 number. It's 1-800-848-6224, and that will connect you to the University of North Carolina Press, which publishes the books for the Institute.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. And if you'd like to get a copy of this show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And tomorrow on Democracy Now! On April Fool's Day, we plan to have the great-grandson of a slave joining us to talk about, well, why April Fool's Day, you'll find out. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!